From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations and comments from the National Humanities Center. In present-day Europe and the United States, the women's movement and feminism are central to social debate. But what can be said of feminism in the Middle East? Soundings put that question to one scholar and a visitor at the National Humanities Center, Leila Ahmed and Herbert Bodman. Leila Ahmed is a native of Cairo, Egypt, and she was educated at Cambridge University. At the National Humanities Center, she's writing a book entitled A Common Past, Women in Middle Eastern History. Herbert Bodman is a professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. The conversation begins with comments from Leila Ahmed about one enduring Middle Eastern stereotype, women and the wearing of the veil.
Well, the veil is it's not really an Islamic custom. I mean, when Islam came to the Middle East, the veil was already in use.
Where did it come from?
I've never seen any final answer to that one. It was used, they say, by the Greeks. It was used, used to some extent. It seemed never to have been absolutely an institution. Mm-hmm. It was used by the Byzantine women. It seemed to be among the upper classes mainly. If a man could afford to keep his women secluded and veiled, that showed that he was a rich man and he'd made it in the world.
Mm-hmm. What does the veil mean? What is its symbolism?
Seclusion,
yes.
Seclusion, protection.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Protection of virginity, protection of femininity.
Is it a symbol of ownership on the part of the males?
Not at all, I don't think.
Uh-huh. How did we get that idea?
What is being protected is not so much, as I see it, the honor of the woman, but the honor of the family and the honor of the male.
Why, don't the men trust the women?
No.
Are they afraid that they're going to shame them? Is that
true?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Exactly. Men are believed to be able to discipline their passions, whereas women are unable to do so.
Where does that idea come from?
Well, I think before answering that, one needs to say that actually this whole notion of a woman's honor having to be protected by a man is not an Islamic notion. It belongs to the Mediterranean area.
Exactly.
And is as prevalent among the Greeks, for instance, as it is among Muslims.
When you come right down to it, it isn't so much the face that is regarded as needing to be covered, but the hair.
The hair?
The hair.
Why is that?
For the same reason as in Christianity, because it's beautiful. It's supposed to seduce, be seductive to men and to angels, at least in Christianity. In Islam, it's just to men.
Yeah. Mm. In mythology, don't you see the hair as an erotic theme a bit?
As in Rapunzel, for instance, a fairy tale, a myth.
Athena, Medusa having the hair of snakes, epitomizing her evil nature. I think it's quite accurate myself. Look at the amount of money spent in our culture on hair salons.
And those of us who have very little.
regret it.
What are some of the other cultural notions about women in the Middle East that Westerners have that, for instance, are inaccurate, Leila?
Yes. Well, the notion of the harem as a place where there's a lot of lust and licentiousness going on. Mm-hmm. That is very much a product of Western men's imagination on the whole. I think one of the things that people think of, they think of in the West of a harem as consisting of men's wives and concubines, whereas really all it means is it's the women's quarters, so that it is not a place of rampant sex, but a place where his sisters and his mother and his aunts and so on are at ease among other women.
So what goes on in the harem?
A lot of tasks that go on that a woman performs in Western society, but I mean like cooking and cleaning and sewing and so on, but done communally rather than individually.
And who goes there?
The relatives of the female relatives of men or of related men can go and come as they please within his
You say relatives, male and female?
No, female.
Uh-huh.
And
males who are within the forbidden bounds of marriage. In other words, men whom the women cannot marry.
Does the harem have a legal basis in relationship, for instance, to the Quran?
It is, in the sense that the Quran permits a man to have four wives, up to four wives.
Permits or encourages?
It doesn't at all encourage. Uh-huh. I mean, the common interpretation of the relevant verse in the Quran is that, in fact, it discourages it, because it says you're allowed to marry up to four if you can treat them equally, but it is not in man's nature to treat equally.
Mm-hmm. So equally economically?
In every sense, emotionally, economically.
It doesn't say.
Yes.
It says just equally, and this depends upon one's interpretation. And mm-hmm. modern interpretations are you really can't treat them equally.
How much is there in the Quran about women?
Well, in inheritance.
Mm-hmm.
Islam was revolutionary for its time in including women in inheritance.
Mm-hmm.
But it included them only as half the share
mm-hmm.
of the equivalent male.
Now, you say for its time. This would date to when, roughly?
To 7th century.
Uh-huh.
7th century. In pre-Islamic Arabia, so far as we know, women had no inheritance rights.
Uh-huh.
So in a sense, this was a reform for that time. Uh-huh. But for its time, it was a definite reform.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, it then became, as you might say, engraved in stone, and times have changed since then.
Just the weight of tradition.
Yeah. Well, mm-hmm. and the fact that the Quran is regarded as the word of God
mm-hmm.
and immutable. And yet there are some very specific passages in the Quran. Women and men must behave and dress modestly.
Mm-hmm.
And women should not be visited by just anyone.
Sexually, you mean?
No.
You're talking about relationships.
Yes, social relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a little bit ambiguous, mm-hmm. because in fact, the prohibition in the Quran on being accessible to other men or of women having to be veiled or secluded applies to the prophet's wives.
Yes.
And it is by
extension.
By extension. But in Muhammad's time, it is thought it was his wives in particular, because they were the wives of the Prophet, who had to be
mm-hmm.
guard themselves, keep them apart from them.
Your questioning is on the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
There's more than that. There is the Sunnah of the Prophet, or the custom of Muhammad.
Now, what does that mean?
Well, this is a whole body of literature which complements the Quran.
As a commentary, for instance?
Not exactly as a commentary.
Just grown up around it.
But it grew up around it. The Quran is only about the length of the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite repetitious. An editor could cut that down by a third. God forbid, I guess, is the thing to
yes,
say at this
yes.
point. And it was an inadequate source for proper conduct. It set guidelines, it set some very specific aspects, but it was also very broad and general and vague in other aspects. So around this grew up, in the 3rd, 4th centuries of Islam, a whole body of literature which was attributed to Muhammad. The parallel in Christianity is the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Because
a compilation of books about various lives.
Yeah, the Bible is the accounts of the apostles, the New Testament at least, is the account of the apostles, by the apostles, of Christ's mm-hmm. life and work. And this is precisely what the Sunnah of the Prophet, the Hadith literature,
mm-hmm.
Is. The revelation in Christianity, of course, is Christ. And that is comparable to the Quran, to a, in a very broad way. comparable.
Let's come back to women.
Yes.
And Westerners' perceptions of women. What does the Quran, what does tradition in the Middle East say about the nature of women?
Well, I think one of the things one has to say is to go back to what we were saying earlier about the coming of Islam and how it sees itself as part of the prophetic tradition of the Judeo-Christian tradition. And that is a lot of it took over. As Herb mentioned, the notions of Adam and Eve and the fall and so on, and it took over as Islam spread from Arabia, it spread to an area where there were Jewish and Christian scholars and who had written about the nature of women, and Islam actually took on a lot of these attitudes into its own tradition. For instance, on the story of Adam and Eve, the Quran regards them equally to have been at fault. Eve did not lead Adam to evil. Satan seduced them both. And in that way, it is a little bit more charitable towards women than either Christianity or Judaism.
And they were both forgetful of their duty. This is not a matter of original sin.
Yes.
But they were simply forgetful.
That's a very important point to differentiate between.
And it has this ramification. In Christianity, particularly medieval Christianity, sexual relations were regarded as something dirty, really. That has never been the case in Islam. Sexual relations have been an act of procreation which God approves. Mm-hmm. And one should do it modestly, but it's perfectly okay. Mm-hmm. There's not the sense of guilt that there is in the Christian tradition.
Does this offset this notion of human sexuality? Does it offset the what I take to be obvious sexual segregation in the Middle East, the separation of men from women?
You are quite right in the question, the matter of segregation. What you have, it seems to me, in the Middle East, and I'd like to hear Layla on this, is that you have two societies mm-hmm. that are really very separate.
Men and women.
Men and women. Men associate with men, women associate with women. Men will congregate in the evenings, let's say, in a coffee house or a tea house, they regard them as being different.
Mm-hmm.
Women have different interests than men in the traditional view. And also, there's this idea that women are more likely to be tempted than men.
So you got to round them up and keep them at home, is that right?
This is the male view.
Mm-hmm.
The women's.
I don't know about that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think not that they're more likely to be tempted, but it's a more serious offense if they are. Men can be tempted, and it's no disaster. It doesn't
mm-hmm.
impugn anybody's honor.
That's
whereas
true.
Women, it would reflect on a man's honor.
Yes.
So it's that rather
yes.
than that they're more likely to
Does
be
Does this
tempted.
Mean that men are more honorable in their natures than women? Therefore, they're more easily offended, more easily tempted?
No, but I think that I don't know if what Herb was thinking of, but the temptation, if one thinks of it's a sexual temptation, it's not a serious thing for a man to be sexually tempted.
Who's more important in the eyes of God in the Middle East, men or women?
They're equally important. Yeah. They're the same religious duties are enjoined on both, mm-hmm. and both mm-hmm. are promised heaven or hell according to how they act. So in the eyes of God, they're completely equal. Yeah.
Well, if you have this sexually segregated society, you have this clear structure and mm-hmm. what appears to be a very conservative view of human nature, is there a place for a word like feminism in the Middle East, Layla?
Yes, in a way, a better place, Wayne, because I think the fact that there is a community of women, there is a sense of solidarity among women, that here has been created by feminism.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas there it exists, the sense that women have interests in common and that they naturally like to be with other women and can support each other against this other world, whenever necessary, of men, all that mm-hmm. is present without feminism. So mm-hmm. you've got a lot of the things that feminists had to fight for here are actually there.
And I might add that in Islamic society, women can own property, have been always endowed with property, a study of 18th century real estate transactions, for example, in the city of Aleppo.
Aleppo is where?
In northern Syria. Points out that something like two-fifths of the transactions relating to property were transactions by women.
Can women be lawyers and doctors and judges in the Middle East?
They can in some countries. They can't be judges, I think, in Egypt at the moment, and several other Muslim countries. I think Turkey is the only country where they can be judges. Is that right?
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
But they can be doctors and lawyers. And again, this has varied enormously over Islamic history, because records show that women in very early Islamic times had professions open to them that later became closed. Mm-hmm. So that it's not inherent in Islam that these professions should not be open to them.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to a conversation about women in the Middle East. My guests are Leila Ahmed and Herbert Bodman. Leila Ahmed is a scholar at the National Humanities Center, where she's writing a book about women in Middle Eastern history. Herbert Bodman is a professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
Leila, let's say that we have two female children, 15 years old, one who lives in Chicago and one who lives in Cairo. And let's assume that we have roughly parallel economic backgrounds in the sense of the opportunities that may or may not await. What is it that the Egyptian little girl can look forward to? How is her life likely to unravel itself?
Well, the question would have been much easier to answer 5 years ago.
Yes. Why is that?
Yes.
Because the Middle East is at the moment, and Cairo, from what I've heard from friends and when I visited it, is in a moment where things are really... 5 years ago, one would have said she would have gone to university.
You could have said this,
yes.
And that.
Now there's an enormous turmoil, particularly of a notion of a revival of a certain kind of Islam, which is seeking to relegate women, to close off things that had been opened.
This is an arch-conservative form.
It is, yes, uh-huh. Yes. And I think one is very aware of that in Cairo now, that you cannot really see.
And I take it that you look at this with some degree of alarm.
I do, indeed.
How is it being viewed there?
It's very difficult, Wayne, because partly it's viewed... not as negatively as I view it, because a lot of people in Egypt and other parts of the Middle East feel that they have been, that their countries, their peoples, their culture has been terribly abused by the West, and that they've had enough of this, and that if the only way to react to stop this anti-Islamic feeling is to go back to Islam and to close themselves off from the West, and they feel then that it is worth it, even if it means the loss of personal liberties.
Well, let's come to women who are more or less on the cutting edge of social change in the Middle East. What would be some of the political goals of women who explicitly or otherwise think of themselves, call themselves feminists in the Middle East? What are they after?
Well, one has to begin by saying that there are very few such women who actually call themselves feminists.
Do they not do that generally?
No.
It's what would that bring down upon them? Ostracism?
No, it wouldn't bring ostracism. I mean, it isn't because it would bring anything down on them. Mm-hmm. It's part of the phenomenon we were talking about earlier of a general disenchantment with Western civilization.
Ah.
And it would... a woman is in a very difficult position if she is at all feminist, because one of the things, for instance, that the Muslim world views as unattractive about the West, and also women, is that the way that the West apparently, women are apparently emancipated, but on the other hand, they are treated very much as sex objects, and there's a pressure for them to have sex, for instance, which is very offensive to Muslim women as well as men.
You mean the idea of sexual liberation?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, not liberation. That under the cover of liberation, it's actually a pressure on women to be licentious.
Or to be loose.
Yeah, to be loose, yes.
Yes.
Yeah. That she has to continue, that she has to, one of the defenses of adopting the veil, or at least the the covering for women is that women in the West have to dress so as to titivate men all the time, mm-hmm. and they find mm-hmm. that offensive. And women as well as men find it offensive.
We spoke at the beginning about Western stereotypes of the Middle East. We have to recognize that the Middle East has stereotypes of the
yes,
West,
indeed.
And one of these is the Hollywood stereotype.
Yeah. Yes.
The Hollywood movies.
The sex kitten.
Yes. Okay. Hollywood movies have been in the Middle East now for a generation and a half, two generations.
Yes.
And the old 1930s, 40s, 50s image, Hollywood image, has become quite firmly implanted in at least the fantasies of at least the male and I think the female,
yes,
too.
Yes. Politically active women see themselves as achieving what they believe they should have as women, as individuals, the rights that they should have, mainly through other political movements, joining a socialist movement. If you remember, that's how women, the militant women in the Iranian Revolution, who were feminists and socialists, were the first to take on the veil as part of the revolution, because they see as the achieving the rights of women as part of achieving the rights of the individual.
In the same way that feminism, in a sense, in this country, grew out of the whole civil rights
context. That's right.
Context.
It's very parallel. That's uh-huh. right. Yeah. And for instance, this feminist, Nawal Saadawi, and other less articulate feminists, are part of either the socialist revolution or the Palestinian movement.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know of any feminists who are simply feminists, as you find in this society.
I see.
They are part of some other political movement.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that you have a tremendous problem in this region of the feminist movement being an interest that is of a particular small group, subordinated to many other issues. And sometimes it is negated by those other movements. I'm thinking, for example, of the Algerian Revolution, in which women plunged in and participated fully and played very key roles. And then some of them, at least, the feminists among them, expected to have a very different life after the revolution.
And did not.
It didn't mm-hmm. happen. It didn't happen. Because the males, essentially, the male revolutionaries, exploited them. I don't think they felt exploited at the time, but they certainly did afterward.
Mm-hmm.
And they did not gain what they expected to gain. And there have been setbacks. For example, Jehan Sadat, Anwar Sadat's wife, was a moderate feminist leader. But with Sadat's assassination and then the his passing into political oblivion, let's say, she's lost out. Mm-hmm. And I think this has created a setback for the feminist movement in Egypt, because she was identified with him. And now that there's something of a reaction to him in Egypt. It comes back to this point, I think, that socially, the Middle East, in many ways, is moving slower than it is politically. That politics has central stage. Modernization of society is, I think, next. And the women's movement is down underneath all of that,
but
behind it.
It's more than that, you know. It's not only okay. that it's moving at a slower pace. In recent years, countries that have moved towards this goal of modernization have rejected that as a goal at all and have revoked
yes.
laws which
yes.
were which right. gave liberties to women that they had not had before.
Yes.
So it's
yeah.
more than that. It's
yeah.
actually moving against it.
Right.
If you could say that there are certain things at the core, certain things central to women's concerns in the Middle East and in the West, what would they be?
Well, when you, I react differently. The first thing that comes to mind with Muslim world is the rights to have greater rights with respect to divorce is the most, one of the most crucial
right.
things in the Muslim world.
Right.
With respect to custody over their children.
Right.
With respect to whether they want to be one of several wives or whether they want to be part of a monogamous marriage and whether they have the right to refuse to be part of more than
And how far away are these as goals for women in the Middle East? Are they still things that
it
women
depends.
Talk about?
I would say it depends upon their economic level.
Mm-hmm.
I see the status of women being the hardest, the most resistant to change
mm-hmm.
of the whole panoply of social relations or of political liberties, because it is so deeply embedded in the male psyche and in the home education, particularly in the lower classes, and even it's an emotional response in the upper classes, because you're dealing with a sexual subject, and that's an emotional subject.
Well, that relates to what you were saying, Wayne, because in that is actually true, to my mind, of Western society as well. It is the most difficult subject, and that is why things like ERA get defeated, and that it is, it comes right into one's home, one's personal life.
The family.
Yeah.
The family is. And in Islamic society, the family is critically important. This is the cornerstone, really, of society. And the Middle East male, and I think I can say the Christian minority in the Middle East, as well as the Muslim, and as far as that goes, for much of the Jewish population in Israel, too. There's a feminist problem in Israel, as the Israeli women are speaking out more and more against the disillusionment of female society in Israel. So this is a whole cultural phenomenon that pretty well spans the spectrum in different degrees, but it's across the board. That the family is the critical dimension, and the male population feel very definitely that it has to be maintained. It's part of their machismo, and many women agree with it. They won't challenge it.
You've been listening to Soundings, conversations and comments from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond. My guests were Leila Ahmed and Herbert Bodman. Leila Ahmed teaches English at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. At the National Humanities Center, she's writing a book about women in Middle Eastern history. Herbert Bodman teaches in the Department of History at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina 27709. Soundings is made possible by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities.